It's good to be here. I don't remember exactly the last time I spoke. If I had to guess, I'd say it was about 6 months ago that I was here. And I distinctly remember getting up here and thanking Ed for his class because it tied into to some of the things that I was going to say. And so I don't remember what his class was then, and so I don't remember exactly what he said. So then I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, well, did that actually happen, or am I just having deja vu here? But I'd like to thank him this morning for some of the things that he said that is going to tie into to what I'm going to say this morning. And that may have happened last time, or my memory's just starting to fail me. One of the two. Ken Perot said, "There is a supernatural force within the working of within the workings of love that none of us, not even scientists, can deny." Again, there is a supernatural force within the workings of love that none of us, not even scientists, can deny. A supernatural force working within love. I believe that I've known this or perhaps believed this in the past, but I'd never thought of it in this term. Think about it. Think about love. And here Ken Perot, an author, says that he believes there's a supernatural force working within that. And we know that love is powerful, right? We've probably done things out of love that we wouldn't normally do. We've certainly seen all kinds of young men trying to impress young ladies in the name of love, doing things that aren't maybe necessarily the wisest, but driving all night, doing all kinds of things that we would consider odd under normal circumstances. But in the name of love, they're done. A supernatural force within love. And as I thought about this quote a little bit, it makes perfect sense because 1 John, the fourth chapter, tells us exactly about that. I won't take the time to turn there, but 1 John chapter 4, talking about love, says a very famous statement in there that God is love. It doesn't say that God has love. It doesn't say that God created love. It says that God is love. God is love. And when I've thought about that, I've always thought of that in the terms of describing God. God is love. But what if we take that and start describing a little bit about love? Within this emotion, whatever it is, and a lot of people have tried to define it, and I don't know that I'm going to give a perfect definition this morning, but within this love, whatever it is the essence of God. Therefore, I have to conclude that it is perhaps the most powerful force on this earth that I have access to, save for the Godhead itself. Love is the most powerful thing that I can tap into, with the exception of the Holy Spirit and God the Father and Son that we're familiar with. I'd like to take a moment this morning and consider some verses that we find in John, the 13th chapter, that Ed also read for us this morning. John chapter 13. And here Christ is talking to some of his disciples. It's toward the end of his life here on this earth. And as he goes through, and it's a fairly famous passage in which he predicts both that Judas is going to betray him and then also later predicts that Peter is going to betray him. But sandwiched in between that, in verses 31 through 35, there's this new commandment or so that he gives to them. And I'm going to start and just read verses 34 and 35. John chapter 13, verses 34 and 35. "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this you will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." I'd like to talk a little bit this morning about living our love. Having this love that Christ is commanding his disciples and apostles to have at this time. And I think there's a few things that we can learn specifically out of these two verses. First of all, it says, "A new commandment I give to you." This is a new commandment I give to you. But if we recall in other passages, when Christ is asked, what's the greatest commandment? What are his answers? He gives two answers. What are they? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind, and love your neighbor. Well, where is that commandment to love your neighbor? That's found in multiple places, but it's found in Leviticus 19:18. So in the Old Testament, they were commanded to love, but yet here Christ says, "A new commandment I give to you, love." Well, how is this a new commandment if Moses commanded the children of Israel in Leviticus 19 to do the same thing? Well, I think we'll find out as we pick this apart a little bit. This new commandment is to A, love one another, but how? B, as I have loved you. In my mind, that's the new commandment. They were commanded to love your neighbor as yourself. Have love like you would have love for yourself. Now you're commanded to love one another as I, Christ, have loved you. That's the new commandment. It's taken up a little bit. And then what else can we learn from this passage in verse 35? By this you will know that my disciples. If you do this, you will know that I am your disciple, or that you are my disciples. Depending upon the version of the Bible that you have in your lap, or the version of Bible that you're reading in there, that you read from, love is found more than about 200 times in the New Testament. Dozens and dozens of verses about love. And we've known that and we've studied this. This isn't a foreign concept to us. It's very important. And as we build upon the foundation that I may have laid with regard to God being love and love being of God, you can understand why it would be so important. But what is love? Love is hard to define, and I didn't turn to Webster's or I didn't turn to Vine or anything. I just kind of thought about this and pondered it. What is love? And we've already said that it is the essence of God, but in maybe a more simple term, I've just defined it as an intense affection. An intense affection and a positive emotion. There's an emotional aspect to this. It's just affection that we have for a person or an individual to the nth degree. And so if I could break down love on perhaps an intellectual level, I think that the emotional side of it is that you value something. Having love is having value for something. Whatever it is that you love, you place value in it. And that's why you're willing to drive all night to see that young girl that you're in love with. Or you're willing to do this or that for our children. Why? Because you value them so much. And related to that, love is service. The value of loving someone is an emotional side of it. And how we express that, the actions associated with that, is the tangible, physical service side of it. So therefore, I've concluded that the depth of our love is related to how much we value someone or something and how willing we are to expend our resources for that someone or something. We have different levels of love, and we know this. I love my friends. I have a number of friends, very good friends, that I've had for many years. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be spending an afternoon with both of Ed's sons. I've known them since I can't remember not knowing them. I've known them since however little you want to make me. I love those guys. They're some of my best friends, but I don't love them the same way that I love my wife. And I think all parties involved are happy about that. We have different levels of love for different levels of people. Matthew 5:44, Christ tells us to love our enemies. But again, that's different than the love that we have in Ephesians 5:25 for our spouses. And this is even borne out more in John 15:13, when Christ says, greater love has no man than this, than to lay his life down for his friends. Greater love. That's the greatest love you can have. And right there implies that it's possible to have what? A lesser form of love, right? Love is not all equal. And yet we are to love one another as Christ loved us, as borne out in John 13:34. So if we have this love and we're commanded to have this love, how do we do this? Practically speaking, how do we apply this? Well, in order to live our love, we must first have love. That might sound simple, but it's one of those things that's a lot easier to say than actually do at times. An Indian philosopher from India, an Indian philosopher named Bara Dada, I may have mispronounced that, forgive me if I did, in the mid-1920s said, and I quote, Jesus is ideal, but you Christians are nothing like him. He respected Jesus. He respected what Jesus taught. He just said the problem with Christianity is the Christians. It's not Christ. And that is a stark wake-up call. And that also, I'm reminded of John 13:35, when he says, by this, all will know that you are my disciples. If we have this love, it stands out. And conversely, if we don't, people notice. So how do we get this love if we don't have it? And I think this is a very real struggle. I've thought about this multiple times in my life. How do I know if I love the Lord enough? How do I know if I love people enough? What is enough? How do you get this? And it's, I think some people just have a natural affinity to be better at this than others. We all have natural talents. Some of us are more affectionate than others. I think some of us are more nurturing than others. Some of us, I think it's easier for them to love than it is for others of us. So how can we get this? I'd like to look a little bit at Christ's love. We're supposed to have this love of Christ, so what are some characteristics of this love? Well, Christ's love was sacrificial. I'm not going to turn there, but in 1 John 3:16, it talks about how he laid down his life for us. We know that. We've talked about that multiple times this morning. So his love was a sacrificial love. His love was also a caring love. In Matthew 22:37, when he stands atop the Mount of Olives and looks down at Jerusalem and says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I long to gather you like a chick, like a hen gathers her chicks." And in John 13, he refers to his disciples as little children. He had a caring and affection for his followers and his disciples. So now we have a sacrificial love and a love that's caring. But here I'd like to underscore a point. Christ's love was committed. It was non-conditional. I'd like to take the time to turn over to Matthew chapter 26. And in Matthew chapter 26, we have a slightly different account than an account that we've already considered once this morning. But in Matthew chapter 26, this is the Last Supper, the Lord's Supper, that Christ is in the upper room with his disciples. And in verses 31 through 34, Christ says, "Then Jesus said to them, 'All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee.' And Peter answered him and said to him, 'Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble.' And Jesus said, 'As surely as I say to you, this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times.'" There at the beginning in verse 31, Christ says, all of you will be made to stumble. This is the inner circle. This is Christ's inner group. Maybe his quote unquote best friends, if we can use that term. This is Christ's best friends, and he looks at them and says, all of you are going to scatter. And yet in John 13, chapter 1, it says, "Now before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, he should depart from this world to the Father. Having loved his own were in the world, he loved them to the end." Here's his best friends, the people that should have stuck with him to the end. He looks them in the eye and says, "You're going to deny me," but did that change his love? Not at all. Christ's love for individuals was not dependent on how they treated him. And that's a powerful lesson, and it's one that's possibly difficult for us to apply in our lives. There are some people that I've already said, there are some people that I have love for, but they could do things to me that would cause that love to evaporate or significantly diminish. You know, if somebody tried to, punch me every time that I see them, or they're trying to poison me every time that I see them. I don't know, we can make something up, but people can do things that will make me not want to love them. That wasn't the way with Christ. Christ's love was not conditional. It was sacrificial, it was caring, and it was committed. And when I reflect on my own life, those are lessons I think are good for me to be reminded of. How else can we perhaps grow our love for the Lord or perhaps others in the world or in the body? Well, I'll pose a question. Do you have to love to be loving? Do you have to love to do loving things? Well, I would say that you don't have to feel the emotional side of love in order to do the physical side of love. You can serve, you can be committed, you can be caring, you can be sacrificial for others without having as much warm fuzzies in your heart for that individual or for that situation or circumstances. You have the choice to behave in a loving manner, and I believe in doing so, then the emotions will follow. You have the choice to do loving things for individuals or for people, for the Lord, for the body, even if you don't feel it in your heart as much as perhaps you think you should. And in time, those emotions will probably follow suit. Are you loving enough in your life? Do you feel that you're loving enough in your life? Well, I'd submit that you probably are. You probably are loving enough. We probably are all loving enough. A better question might be, what is it that we're loving? How do you spend your time? How do you spend your talent? How do you spend your wealth? How much of these are spent on yourself, and how much of these are spent on others and service to the Lord? John chapter 14 and 15, I won't turn there, but Christ says, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." So our actions there convey our hearts. Our behavior, I almost said betrays, I don't want to say betrays, but our behavior conveys what is important in our heart. And so what we spend our time and resources on, I think, is a reflection on what we consider to be important. We are commanded in multiple places to display our love for our brethren in the world. Ephesians 5:2 tells us to walk in love. 1 Corinthians 16:14 says, let all you do be done in love. Have you thought about that? Let all that you do be done in love. Like, all and every are words that kind of make me, I almost said they scare me, but they're words that make me a little bit more uncomfortable. Because all and every is all and every. You can't get away from those. Let all that you do be done in love. In getting with practicality, or in keeping with practically, and how we can maybe get better at displaying this, I'd like to talk about four areas of showing our love and discuss these just a little bit. Because love is a little bit like the wind. You can't see it, but you can see its effects by how we are, by how we behave. And we can see this in Romans chapter 5, verse 8, where it says, but God demonstrated his love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We can see that God loved us. Why? Because he gave us his son. We can't see God's love for us, but we can see that he did because of the sacrifice and the gift that he gave to us. John 3:16 also has a similar phrasing in that he gave his son, this idea of gift giving. And so the first couple of things that I'd like to talk about that might help us display our love for one another and for God is what I will call active activities, things that we can actively do. And one of those is generosity. Of all of our resources, how do we do our money, our time, our teaching, encouraging? How is it that we do with those things, and how generous are we with these things? It's kind of funny, and I'm sure a lot of us can recall examples of people that have been very generous and very giving and done things for us. It's funny how along your life there's just little benchmarks that, I don't know, maybe they don't seem, looking back, maybe that they were that big of a deal. I'm sure in the moment to those other people they weren't that big of a deal, but you remember them. Years later, I remember being about a 14-year-old, I think I was about 14, I'm not sure, 13 or 14, and Eric Owens, a member of the Prince Road congregation, was coming through Kansas City on his way up to Des Moines for the 2-week meeting, and he just happened to try to find out who's a teenager in Kansas City that's not up there. And so he called up, I don't know who he called, somebody up in Pleasant Hill and said, who's a teenager up there that's not there? And my name came up. So all of a sudden he called and he's like, I'm going to be coming through tomorrow. He's like, pack your bags, we're going. Okay, I didn't even hardly know who he was. My parents, I guess, trusted him, or they wanted to get rid of me, I'm not sure. But I mean, I remember that. I don't know. I would guess that Eric probably doesn't really remember that. That's just the kind of guy that Eric is. That's just what he does. But I remember that some 20 plus years later. And that was one of the first meetings that I went to, and I met some friends that I'm still friends with today because of that. Just generous giving, simple things of sharing what we have. And we can overcomplicate things. Well, I would see if there's a teenager that needs a ride, but you know, it'd probably be weird, or maybe their parents won't know me, or this, that, or the other. The timing's not right. We can rationalize our way out of all kinds of good deeds. Generosity isn't intending to do good. It is doing good. And we can overcomplicate this. You know, sometimes you can have a tendency, or at least I've in the past had a tendency myself, of having people over to my house. Well, what are we going to have for dinner? Or what are we going to do, or how clean the house is? And we think that we've got to put out some 5-course turkey dinner or whatever, but it doesn't matter. Just have people over and order pizza. Like, you know, pizza counts. It works. I don't think that God's going to stand in heaven and say, well, you were really hospitable, but you served pizza. I don't think he's going to hold that against us at all. You know, and are you going to stand before the throne and say, well, God, I would have had people over, but, you know, I just didn't, the crock pot wasn't big enough, or whatever, I don't know, food. We make all kinds of excuses. Just do it. Just do it. It benefits us, it benefits the people who we're being hospitable towards or generous towards, and I'm quite certain that it pleases the Lord. Be generous and try not to make excuses for not. It's better to attempt to be generous and fail than to make excuses as to why you shouldn't. Another thing that I think we can do to actively show our love in this world is to value everyone. Value everybody. Sometimes there can be people, personality conflicts or so, that can grate on nerves, or you know, once upon a time he did something to my sister or this or that. And we can kind of have grudges, or we can just kind of look at people less favorably than we ought to. But, you know, every person has value. I heard a sermon given one time, and it was talking about this, about how we need to extend, I don't know if it's olive branches, but generosity, or befriend people that are maybe a little more difficult to befriend. And the title of the sermon was called Hugging Porcupines. It's like, you know, sometimes you have to hug people that are a little more difficult to hug. And yeah, you might get poked a little bit, but that's better than avoiding them. Everybody has value. Look at things from their point of view. If we see John chapter 4, the Samaritan woman, Christ was good to that woman who was, by the world standards, a lesser citizen. Or Luke 19, Zacchaeus, the sinner, the tax collectors, all number of things that Christ was spending time with. And yet they would have been considered second-class citizens. They were the undesirable of society in the Jewish minds, and yet Christ spent a number of time and effort and amounts to befriend those people and extend goodwill to them. Value everybody. Everybody has value, even if they might be a little bit trickier for us to get along with. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't try and shouldn't be loving towards them. A couple of other things now, the two last things I'd like to talk about are what I'll consider reactive. And this might tie a little bit into the previous one, but having patience. Colossians 3, 12 and 13 tells us that we ought to bear with one another. And Galatians 6 also tells us we ought to bear with one another's burdens. Bearing with one another can be hard, especially if you have a close proximity with people for a long period of time. You know, if you think you're friends with somebody, go on a 3-week vacation with them and see if you come home still friends. You know, you spend that much time and that much proximity with people in that short amount of time. Sometimes you find things that are maybe a little annoying, things that are a little ruffle your feathers more than maybe you thought. But we ought to have patience. Value them, understand that they come from a different place, and focus on the good. I know for a fact that I do things that annoy my wife. But thankfully, she doesn't dwell on those things 24/7. She finds the few nuggets of what she considers to be redeeming qualities in me, and she focuses on those. We can nitpick anybody and pick apart the bad things, but don't. Focus on the good. Focus on the good. Most people aren't half bad at all. Most people aren't even close to half bad. Most people are only 5 or 10% bad, if that, but yet we think that they're just horrible people. But they've got so many good qualities. And also, lastly, as I start to draw my thoughts to a close, we ought to forgive. Don't withhold forgiveness. Withholding forgiveness is prideful, it's unhealthy, and candidly, it's not godly. And if you think about why would we withhold forgiveness, it's oftentimes because we feel wronged. It's because we're hurt. It's really because, I take that back, I'm projecting on you. In my life, times that I've withheld forgiveness are because the wounds cut deep. And I want to lick them for a little while, and I just don't want to forgive. I want to hold on to it because I felt that I was hurt that bad. You wronged me. And that's pride. It's nothing more than pride. Why do we hurt? Why did God even create hurt to start with? Well, it's just so that we know how he feels when we hurt him. If we're hurting because somebody wronged us, instead of getting mad at that person for wronging us, maybe we should humble ourselves and think about how hurt God was for the 83 things that we've wronged him. Instead of withholding our forgiveness, understand the emotions are possibly how God feels when we transgress. And lastly, what is the result of all of this? So if we do these loving things, if we forgive, if we're patient, if we're generous, if we're loving, what's the result? Well, as I already touched on it in John 13, verse 35, by this all will know that you are my disciples. If you want to let your light shine to the world, do these things. They're simple, but they are not easy. And not only are they not easy, they aren't normal. The influence that we exert on people is powerful. And if our efforts are clothed with the love, it has even more power. We influence people all day long at work, at home, in our families, in our neighborhoods, and things like that. And if those influences are clothed with love of Christ, that supernatural power that we find in 1 John chapter 4 of God being love will impact those things. Honest and sincere love, Ed kind of talked about this indirectly, but honest and sincere love may be our most powerful evangelistic tool. Just neighbor sharing with neighbor, friend sharing with friend, about the passion and the sincerity and the contagiousness of the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. And also our relationships within and without of the church will be healthier. We will have healthier churches, we will have healthier families, and we will be pleasing our Father if we can do all these things. The benefits are just almost innumerable. I just highlighted a few of those things. If we can consistently apply these things to our lives. I'd like to draw my thoughts to a close, or start to here. If you were told that you only had a short amount of time left on this earth, and you can make up the time frame there, but a fairly short amount of time left on this earth, would you be more loving? Would your impact, would your behavior be more loving? Would you be less selfish and more loving towards others? And if so, why would you have to wait until the end of your life? Why not do those things now? John 15 and 12 says, "Love one another as I have loved you." If there's anything that we can do for you, if anybody would like to accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior and accept the most loving gift that has ever been offered to mankind, please come forward as we stand and sing.